His heart contracted, and the blood rushed to his face. Let him see whether I'm a coward, he thought. Again, on all the bright faces of the squadron, the serious expression appeared that they had worn when under fire. Rostov watched his enemy, the colonel, closely, to find in his face confirmation of his own conjecture. But the colonel did not once glance at Rostov, and looked as he always did when at the front, solemn and stern. Then came the word of command. Look sharp! Look sharp! Several voices repeated around him. Their sabers catching in the bridles, and their spurs jingling, the hussars hastily dismounted, not knowing what they were to do. The men were crossing themselves. Rostov no longer looked at the colonel. He had no time. He was afraid of falling behind the hussars, so much afraid that his heart stood still. His hand trembled as he gave his horse into an orderly's charge, and he felt the blood rush to his heart with a thud. Denisov rode past him, leaning back and shouting something. Rostov saw nothing but the hussars running all around him, their spurs catching and their sabers clattering. "Stretchers!" shouted someone behind him. Rostov did not think what this call for stretchers meant. He ran on, trying only to be ahead of the others. But just at the bridge, not looking at the ground, he came on some sticky, trodden mud, stumbled, and fell on his hands. The others outstripped him. "At both sides, Captain!" he heard the voice of the colonel, who, having ridden ahead, had pulled up his horse near the bridge with a triumphant, cheerful face. Rostov, wiping his muddy hands on his breeches, looked at his enemy and was about to run on, thinking that the farther he went to the front, the better. But Bogdanich, without looking at or recognizing Rostov, shouted to him, "Who's that running on the middle of the bridge? To the right! Come back, cadet!" he cried angrily, and turning to Denisov, who, showing off his courage, had ridden onto the planks of the bridge, "Why run risks, Captain? You should dismount," he said. "Oh, every bullet has its billet," answered Vaska Denisov, turning in his saddle. Meanwhile, Nizvitsky, Zhirkov, and the officer of the suite were standing together out of range of the shots, watching now the small group of men with yellow shackles, dark green jackets braided with cord, and blue riding breeches, who were swarming near the bridge, and then at what was approaching in the distance from the opposite side, the blue uniforms and groups with horses, easily recognizable as artillery. Will they burn the bridge or not? Who'll get there first? Will they get there and fire the bridge, or will the French get within grapeshot range and wipe them out? These were the questions each man of the troops on the high ground above the bridge involuntarily asked himself with a sinking heart, watching the bridge and the hussars in the bright evening light, and the blue tunics advancing from the other side with their bayonets and guns. "Ah, the hussars will get it hot," said Nizvitsky. "They're within grapeshot range now." "He shouldn't have taken so many men," said the officer of the suite. "True enough," answered Nizvitsky. "Two smart fellows could have done the job just as well." "Ah, Your Excellency," put in Zhirkov, his eyes fixed on the hussars, but still with that naive air that made it impossible to know whether he was speaking in jest or in earnest. "Ah, Your Excellency, how you look at things. Send two men? And who then would give us the Vladimir medal and ribbon? But now, even if they do get peppered, the squadron may be recommended for honors, and he may get a ribbon. Our Bogdanich knows how things are done." "There now," said the officer of the suite. "That's grapeshot." He pointed to the French guns, the limbers of which were being detached and hurriedly removed. On the French side, amid the groups with cannon, a cloud of smoke appeared, then a second and a third almost simultaneously, and at the moment when the first report was heard, a fourth was seen. Then two reports, one after another, and a third. "Oh," groaned Nizvitsky, as if in fierce pain, seizing the officer of the suite by the arm. "Look, a man has fallen. Fallen, fallen. Two, I think. If I were Tsar, I would never go to war," said Nizvitsky, turning away. The French guns were hastily reloaded. The infantry in their blue uniforms advanced toward the bridge at a run. Smoke appeared again, but at irregular intervals, and grapeshot cracked and rattled onto the bridge. But this time Nizvitsky could not see what was happening there, as a dense cloud of smoke arose from it. The hussars had succeeded in setting it on fire, and the French batteries were now firing at them, no longer to hinder them, but because the guns were trained and there was someone to fire at. The French had time to fire three rounds of grapeshot before the hussars got back to their horses. Two were misdirected, and the shot went too high, but the last round fell in the midst of a group of hussars and knocked three of them over. Rostov, absorbed by his relations with Bogdanich, had paused on the bridge, not knowing what to do. There was no one to hew down, as he had always imagined battles to himself, nor could he help to fire the bridge because he had not brought any burning straw with him like the other soldiers. He stood looking about him when suddenly he heard a rattle on the bridge as if nuts were being spilt, and the hussar nearest to him fell against the rails with a groan. Rostov ran up to him with the others. Again someone shouted, "Stretchers!" Four men seized the hussar and began lifting him.
"Oh, for Christ's sake, let me alone!"
cried the wounded man, but still he was lifted and laid on the stretcher. Nicholas Rostov turned away and, as if searching for something, gazed into the distance, at the waters of the Danube, at the sky and at the sun. How beautiful the sky looked! How blue, how calm, and how deep! How bright and glorious was the setting sun! With what soft glitter the waters of the distant Danube shone! And fairer still were the faraway blue mountains beyond the river, the nunnery, the mysterious gorges, and the pine forests veiled in mist to their summits. There was peace and happiness. "I should wish for nothing else, nothing, if only I were there," thought Rostov. "In myself alone and in that sunshine, there is so much happiness. But here, groan, suffering, fear, and this uncertainty and hurry. There, they're shouting again, and again are all running back somewhere, and I shall run with them. And it, death, is here above me and around. Another instant, I shall never again see this sun, this water, that gorge." At that instant, the sun began to hide behind the clouds, and other stretchers came into view before Rostov. And the fear of death and of the stretchers, and love of the sun and of life, all merged into one feeling of sickening agitation. "O Lord God, thou who art in that heaven, save, forgive, and protect me," Rostov whispered. The hussars ran back to the men who held their horses. Their voices sounded louder and calmer. The stretchers disappeared from sight.
"Well, friend, so you've smelt powder," shouted Vaska Denisov just above his ear.
"It's all over, but I'm a coward. Yes, a coward," thought Rostov. And sighing deeply, he took Rook, his horse, which stood resting one foot, from the orderly, and began to mount. "Was that grape shot?" he asked Denisov.
"Yes, and no mistake," cried Denisov. "You worked like regular bwicks, and it's nasty work. An attack's pleasant work, hacking away at the dogs, but this sort of thing is the very devil, with them shooting at you like a target."
And Denisov rode up to a group that had stopped near Rostov, composed of the colonel, Nizvitsky, Zhirkov, and the officer from the suite. "Well, it seems that no one has noticed," thought Rostov. And this was true. No one had taken any notice, for everyone knew the sensation which the cadet under fire for the first time had experienced.
"Here's something for you to report," said Zhirkov. "See if I don't get promoted to a sub-lieutenancy." "Inform the prince that I, the bridge, fired," said the colonel triumphantly and gaily.
"And if he asks about the losses?"
"A trifle," said the colonel in his bass voice. "Two hussars wounded and one knocked out,"
he added, unable to restrain a happy smile and pronouncing the phrase "knocked out" with ringing distinctness. Chapter 6. Prince Andrew sent with dispatches to the Austrian court. The Minister of War. Pursued by the French army of 100,000 men under the command of Bonaparte, encountering a population that was unfriendly to it, losing confidence in its allies, suffering from shortness of supplies, and compelled to act under conditions of war unlike anything that had been foreseen, the Russian army of 35,000 men commanded by Kutuzov was hurriedly retreating along the Danube, stopping where overtaken by the enemy, and fighting rearguard actions only as far as necessary to enable it to retreat without losing its heavy equipment. There had been actions at Lambach, Amstetten, and Melk, but despite the courage and endurance, acknowledged even by the enemy, with which the Russians fought, the only consequence of these actions was a yet more rapid retreat. Austrian troops that had escaped capture at Ulm and had joined Kutuzov at Braunau now separated from the Russian army and Kutuzov was left with only his own weak and exhausted forces. The defense of Vienna was no longer to be thought of. Instead of an offensive, the plan of which, carefully prepared in accord with the modern science of strategics, had been handed to Kutuzov when he was in Vienna by the Austrian Hofkriegsrat, the sole and almost unattainable aim remaining for him was to effect a junction with the forces that were advancing from Russia without losing his army, as Mack had done at Ulm. On the 28th of October, Kutuzov with his army crossed to the left bank of the Danube and took up a position for the first time with the river between himself and the main body of the French. On the 30th, he attacked Mortier's division, which was on the left bank, and broke it up. In this action, for the first time, trophies were taken, banners, cannon, and two enemy generals. For the first time, after a fortnight's retreat, the Russian troops had halted, and after a fight had not only held the field, but had repulsed the French. Though the troops were ill-clad, exhausted, and had lost a third of their number in killed, wounded, sick, and stragglers, though a number of sick and wounded had been abandoned on the other side of the Danube with a letter in which Kutuzov entrusted them to the humanity of the enemy, and though the big hospitals and the houses in Krems, converted into military hospitals, could no longer accommodate all the sick and wounded, yet the stand made at Krems and the victory over Mortier raised the spirits of the army considerably. Throughout the whole army and at headquarters, most joyful though erroneous rumors were rife of the imaginary approach of columns from Russia, of some victory gained by the Austrians, and of the retreat of the frightened Bonaparte. Prince Andrew, during the battle, had been in attendance on the Austrian General Schmidt, who was killed in the action. His horse had been wounded under him, and his own arm slightly grazed by a bullet. As a mark of the Commander-in-Chief's special favor, he was sent with the news of this victory to the Austrian court, now no longer at Vienna, which was threatened by the French, but at Brünn. Despite his apparently delicate build, Prince Andrew could endure physical fatigue far better than many very muscular men. And on the night of the battle, having arrived at Krems excited but not weary, with dispatches from Dokhturov to Kutuzov, he was sent immediately with a special dispatch to Brünn. To be so sent meant not only a reward, but an important step toward promotion. The night was dark but starry. The road showed black in the snow that had fallen the previous day, the day of the battle. Reviewing his impressions of the recent battle, picturing pleasantly to himself the impression his news of a victory would create, or recalling the send-off given him by the Commander-in-Chief and his fellow officers, Prince Andrew was galloping along in a post-chaise, enjoying the feelings of a man who has at length begun to attain a long-desired happiness. As soon as he closed his eyes, his ears seemed filled with the rattle of the wheels and the sensation of victory. Then he began to imagine that the Russians were running away and that he himself was killed. But he quickly roused himself with a feeling of joy, as if learning afresh that this was not so, but that, on the contrary, the French had run away. He again recalled all the details of the victory, and his own calm courage during the battle, and feeling reassured, he dozed off. The dark, starry night was followed by a bright, cheerful morning. The snow was thawing in the sunshine. The horses galloped quickly, and on both sides of the road were forests of different kinds, fields and villages. At one of the post stations, he overtook a convoy of Russian wounded. The Russian officer in charge of the transport lolled back in the front cart, shouting and scolding a soldier with coarse abuse. In each of the long German carts, six or more pale, dirty, bandaged men were being jolted over the stony road. Some of them were talking, he heard Russian words. Others were eating bread. The more severely wounded looked silently with the languid interest of sick children at the envoy hurrying past them. Prince Andrew told his driver to stop and asked a soldier in what action they had been wounded. "Day before yesterday, on the Danube," answered the soldier. Prince Andrew took out his purse and gave the soldier 3 gold pieces. "That's for them all," he said to the officer who came up. "Get well soon, lads," he continued, turning to the soldiers. "There's plenty to do still." "What news, sir?" asked the officer, evidently anxious to start a conversation. "Good news. Go on," he shouted to the driver, and they galloped on. It was already quite dark when Prince Andrew rattled over the paved streets of Brünn and found himself surrounded by high buildings, the lights of shops, houses, and street lamps, fine carriages, and all that atmosphere of a large and active town which is always so attractive to a soldier after camp life. Despite his rapid journey and sleepless night, Prince Andrew, when he drove up to the palace, felt even more vigorous and alert than he had done the day before. Only his eyes gleamed feverishly, and his thoughts followed one another with extraordinary clearness and rapidity. He again vividly recalled the details of the battle, no longer dim but definite, and in the concise form in which he imagined himself stating them to the Emperor Francis. He vividly imagined the casual questions that might be put to him and the answers he would give. He expected to be at once presented to the Emperor. At the chief entrance to the palace, however, an official came running out to meet him, and learning that he was a special messenger, led him to another entrance. To the right from the corridor, Euer Hochgeboren, Your Honor, there you will find the adjutant on duty, said the official. He will conduct you to the Minister of War. The adjutant on duty, meeting Prince Andrew, asked him to wait and went into the Minister of War. 5 minutes later, he returned, and bowing with particular courtesy, ushered Prince Andrew before him along a corridor to the cabinet where the Minister of War was at work. The adjutant, by his elaborate courtesy, appeared to wish to ward off any attempt at familiarity on the part of the Russian messenger. Prince Andrew's joyous feeling was considerably weakened as he approached the door of the minister's room. He felt offended, and without his noticing it, the feeling of offense immediately turned into one of disdain, which was quite uncalled for. His fertile mind instantly suggested to him a point of view which gave him a right to despise the adjutant and the minister. Away from the smell of powder, they probably think it easy to gain victories, he thought. His eyes narrowed disdainfully, he entered the room of the Minister of War with peculiarly deliberate steps. This feeling of disdain was heightened when he saw the minister seated at a large table reading some papers and making pencil notes on them, and for the first 2 or 3 minutes taking no notice of his arrival. A wax candle stood at each side of the minister's bent, bald head with its gray temples. He went on reading to the end without raising his eyes at the opening of the door and the sound of footsteps. "Take this and deliver it," said he to his adjutant, handing him the papers and still taking no notice of the special messenger. Prince Andrew felt that either the actions of Kutuzov's army interested the Minister of War less than any of the other matters he was concerned with, or he wanted to give the Russian special messenger that impression. "But that is a matter of perfect indifference to me," he thought. The minister drew the remaining papers together, arranged them evenly, and then raised his head. He had an intellectual and distinctive head, but the instant he turned to Prince Andrew, the firm, intelligent expression on his face changed in a way evidently deliberate and habitual to him. His face took on the stupid, artificial smile, which does not even attempt to hide its artificiality, of a man who is continually receiving many petitioners one after another. "From General Field Marshal Kutuzov?" he asked. "I hope it is good news. There has been an encounter with Mortier, a victory. It was high time." He took the dispatch which was addressed to him and began to read it with a mournful expression. "Oh, my God, Schmidt," he exclaimed in German. "What a calamity, what a calamity." Having glanced through the dispatch, he laid it on the table and looked at Prince Andrew, evidently considering something. "Ah, what a calamity. You say the affair was decisive, but Mortier is not captured." Again he pondered. "I am very glad you have brought good news, though Schmidt's death is a heavy price to pay for the victory. His Majesty will no doubt wish to see you, but not today. I thank you. You must have a rest. Be at the levee tomorrow after the parade. However, I will let you know." The stupid smile which had left his face while he was speaking reappeared. "Au revoir. Thank you very much. His Majesty will probably desire to see you," he added, bowing his head. When Prince Andrew left the palace, he felt that all the interest and happiness the victory had afforded him had been now left in the indifferent hands of the Minister of War and the polite adjutant. The whole tenor of his thoughts instantaneously changed. The battle seemed the memory of a remote event long past. Chapter 7. Prince Andrew and Bilibin. Note. There is reason to suppose that Bilibin, B-I-L-I-B-I-N, is drawn partly from Prince A.M. Gortchakov, who directed Russian foreign policy for many years from 1856 onwards. He was said to be in love with his inkpot and to show more ability in the concoction of epigrams than in the conduct of political affairs. Prince Andrew stayed at Brünn with Bilibin, a Russian acquaintance of his in the diplomatic service. "Ah, my dear prince, I could not have a more welcome visitor," said Bilibin as he came out to meet Prince Andrew. "Franz, put the prince's things in my bedroom," said he to the servant who was ushering Bolkonski in. "So you're a messenger of victory, eh? Splendid. And I'm sitting here ill, as you see." After washing and dressing, Prince Andrew came into the diplomat's luxurious study and sat down to the dinner prepared for him. Bilibin settled down comfortably beside the fire. After his journey and the campaign, during which he had been deprived of all the comforts of cleanliness and all the refinements of life, Prince Andrew felt a pleasant sense of repose among luxurious surroundings such as he had been accustomed to from childhood. Besides, it was pleasant, after his reception by the Austrians, to speak, if not in Russian, for they were speaking French, at least with a Russian, who would, he supposed, share the general Russian antipathy to the Austrians, which was then particularly strong. Bilibin was a man of 35, a bachelor, and of the same circle as Prince Andrew. They had known each other previously in Petersburg, but had become more intimate when Prince Andrew was in Vienna with Kutuzov. Just as Prince Andrew was a young man who gave promise of rising high in the military profession, so to an even greater extent Bilibin gave promise of rising in his diplomatic career. He was still a young man, but no longer a young diplomat, as he had entered the service at the age of 16, had been in Paris and Copenhagen, and now held a rather important post in Vienna. Both the foreign minister and our ambassador in Vienna knew him and valued him. He was not one of those many diplomats who are esteemed because they have certain negative qualities, avoid doing certain things, and speak French. He was one of those who, liking work, knew how to do it, and despite his indolence, would sometimes spend a whole night at his writing table. He worked equally well, whatever the import of his work. It was not the question, what for, but the question how, that interested him. What the diplomatic matter might be, he did not care, but it gave him great pleasure to prepare a circular, memorandum, or report, skillfully, pointedly, and elegantly. Bilibin's services were valued not only for what he wrote, but also for his skill in dealing and conversing with those in the highest spheres. Bilibin liked conversation, as he liked work, only when it could be made elegantly witty. In society, he always awaited an opportunity to say something striking and took part in a conversation only when that was possible. His conversation was always sprinkled with wittily original, finished phrases of general interest. These sayings were prepared in the inner laboratory of his mind in a portable form, as if intentionally, so that insignificant society people might carry them from drawing room to drawing room. And, in fact, Bilibin's witticisms were hawked about in the Viennese drawing rooms and often had an influence on matters considered important. His thin, worn, sallow face was covered with deep wrinkles, which always looked as clean and well-washed as the tips of one's fingers after a Russian bath. The movement of these wrinkles formed the principal play of expression on his face. Now his forehead would pucker into deep folds and his eyebrows were lifted. Then his eyebrows would descend, and deep wrinkles would crease his cheeks. His small, deep-set eyes always twinkled and looked out straight. "Well, now tell me about your exploits," said he. Bolkonski, very modestly, without once mentioning himself, described the engagement and his reception by the Minister of War. "They received me and my news as one receives a dog in a game of skittles," said he in conclusion. Bilibin smiled, and the wrinkles on his face disappeared. "Cependant, mon cher, but my dear fellow," he remarked, examining his nails from a distance, and puckering the skin above his left eye.
Malgré la haute estime que je professe pour,
with all my respects for, the Orthodox Russian army,
j'avoue que votre victoire n'est pas des plus victorieuses.
I must say that your victory was not particularly victorious. He went on talking in this way in French, uttering only those words in Russian on which he wished to put a contemptuous emphasis.
Come now, you with all your forces fall on the unfortunate Mortier and his one division, and even then Mortier slips through your fingers. Where's the victory?
But seriously, said Prince Andrew, we can at any rate say without boasting that it was a little better than at Ulm.
Why didn't you capture one, just one marshal for us?
Because not everything happens as one expects, or with the smoothness of a parade. We had expected, as I told you, to get at their rear by 7 in the morning, but had not reached it by 5 in the afternoon.
And why didn't you do it at 7 in the morning?
You ought to have been there at 7 in the morning, returned Bilibin with a smile.
You ought to have been there at 7 in the morning.
Why did you not succeed in impressing on Bonaparte by diplomatic methods that he had better leave Genoa alone? Retorted Prince Andrew in the same tone.
I know, interrupted Bilibin. You're thinking it's very easy to take Marshall sitting on a sofa by the fire.
That is true, but still, why didn't you capture him? So don't be surprised if not only the Minister of War, but also His Most August Majesty the Emperor and King Francis is not much delighted by your victory. Even I, a poor secretary of the Russian Embassy, do not feel any need and token of my joy to give my Franz a thaler, or let him go with his Liebchen to the Prater. True, we have no Prater here.
He looked straight at Prince Andrew and suddenly unwrinkled his forehead.
It is now my turn to ask you why, mon cher, said Bolkonski. I confess I do not understand. Perhaps there are diplomatic subtleties here beyond my feeble intelligence, but I can't make it out. Mack loses a whole army. The Archduke Ferdinand and the Archduke Karl give no signs of life and make blunder after blunder. Kutuzov alone at last gains a real victory, destroying the spell of the invincibility of the French, and the Minister of War does not even care to hear the details.
That's just it, my dear fellow. You see, it's hurrah for the Tsar, for Russia, for the Orthodox Greek faith. All that is beautiful, but what do we, I mean, the Austrian court, care for your victories? Bring us nice news of a victory by the Archduke Karl or Ferdinand. One archduke's as good as another, as you know. And even if it is only over a fire brigade of Bonaparte's, that will be another story, and we'll fire off some cannon. But this sort of thing seems done on purpose to vex us. The Archduke Karl does nothing. The Archduke Ferdinand disgraces himself. You abandon Vienna, give up its defense, as much as to say, heaven is with us, but heaven help you and your capital. The one general whom we all loved, Schmidt, you exposed to a bullet, and then you congratulate us on the victory. Admit that more irritating news than yours could not have been conceived. It's as if it had been done on purpose, on purpose. Besides, suppose you did gain a brilliant victory. If even the Archduke Karl gained a victory, what effect would that have on the general course of events?
It's too late now when Vienna is occupied by the French army.
What? Occupied? Vienna occupied?
Not only occupied, but Bonaparte is at Schönbrunn, and the Count, our dear Count Burbna, goes to him for orders.
After the fatigues and impressions of the journey, his reception, and especially after having dined, Bolkonski felt that he could not take in the full significance of the words he heard.
Count Lichtenfels was here this morning, Bilibin continued, and showed me a letter in which the parade of the French in Vienna was fully described. Prince Murat et tout le tremblement, and all the bustle.
You see that your victory is not a matter for great rejoicing, and that you can't be received as a savior.
Really, I don't care about that. I don't care at all, said Prince Andrew,
beginning to understand that his news of the battle before Krems was really of small importance in view of such events as the fall of Austria's capital.
How is it Vienna was taken? What of the bridge and its celebrated bridgehead and Prince Auersperg? We heard reports that Prince Auersperg was defending Vienna, he said. Prince Auersperg is on this, on our side of the river, and is defending us. Doing it very badly, I think, but still he is defending us. But Vienna is on the other side. Now, the bridge has not yet been taken, and I hope it will not be, for it is mined, and orders have been given to blow it up. Otherwise, we should long ago have been in the mountains of Bohemia, and you and your army would have spent a bad quarter of an hour between two fires. But still, this does not mean that the campaign is over, said Prince Andrew.
Well, I think it is. The bigwigs here think so, too.
But they daren't say so. It will be, as I said, at the beginning of the campaign. It won't be your skirmishing at Dürrenstein or gunpowder at all that will decide the matter. But those who devised it, said Bilibin, quoting one of his own mots, releasing the wrinkles on his forehead and pausing. The only question is, what will come of the meeting between the Emperor Alexander and the King of Prussia in Berlin? If Prussia joins the Allies, Austria's hand will be forced and there will be war. If not, it is merely a question of settling where the preliminaries of the new Campo Formio are to be drawn up.
What an extraordinary genius, Prince Andrew suddenly exclaimed, clenching his small hand and striking the table with it. And what luck the man has.
Buonaparte, said Bilibin inquiringly, puckering up his forehead to indicate that he was about to say something witty. Buonaparte, he repeated, accentuating the U.
I think, however, now that he lays down laws for Austria at Schönbrunn,
il faut lui faire grâce de lui. We must let him off the U.
I shall certainly adopt an innovation and call him simply Bonaparte.
But joking apart, said Prince Andrew, do you really think the campaign is over?
This is what I think. Austria has been made a fool of, and she's not used to it. She will retaliate. And she's been fooled in the first place because her provinces have been pillaged. They say the Holy Russian Army loots terribly. Her army is destroyed, her capital taken, and all this for the beaux yeux, the fine eyes, of his Sardinian Majesty.
Note, at the Potsdam Conference, Prussia insisted that an ultimatum should be sent to Napoleon, which, among other demands, stipulated that he should compensate the King of Sardinia. Napoleon rejected all the demands, but Prussia was so frightened by his defeat of the Austrians that it remained passive.
And therefore, this is between ourselves, I instinctively feel that we are being deceived. My instinct tells me of negotiations with France and projects for peace, a secret peace concluded separately.
Impossible, cried Prince Andrew. That would be too base.
If we live, we shall see, replied Bilibin, his face again becoming smooth as a sign that the conversation was at an end.
Note, the Emperor Francis was at that time actually asking Napoleon for a truce, but in reply only received from him insulting demands, the withdrawal of the Russian army, an immediate cession of Venice and the Tyrol, and to furnish securities. Then we can talk about peace. Even Francis did not accede to these terms.
When Prince Andrew reached the room prepared for him and lay down in a clean shirt on the feather bed with its warmed and fragrant pillows, he felt that the battle of which he had brought tidings was far, far away from him. The alliance with Prussia, Austria's treachery, Bonaparte's new triumph, tomorrow's levee and parade, and the audience with the Emperor Francis occupied his thoughts. He closed his eyes, and immediately a sound of cannonading, of musketry, and the rattling of carriage wheels seemed to fill his ears. And now again, drawn out in a thin line, the musketeers were descending the hill. The French were firing, and he felt his heart palpitating as he rode forward beside Schmidt, with the bullets merrily whistling all around, and he experienced tenfold the joy of living, as he had not done since childhood. He woke up.
Yes, that all happened, he said, and smiling happily to himself like a child, he fell into a deep, youthful slumber.
Chapter 8.
Hippolyte Kouragin and Les Nôtres.
Next day he woke late. Recalling his recent impressions, the first thought that came into his mind was that today he had to be presented to the Emperor Francis. He remembered the Minister of War, the polite Austrian adjutant, Bilibin, and last night's conversation. Having dressed for his attendance at court in full parade uniform, which he had not worn for a long time, he went into Bilibin's study, fresh, animated, and handsome, with his hand bandaged. In the study were four gentlemen of the diplomatic corps. With Prince Hippolyte Kouragin, who was a secretary to the embassy, Bolkonski was already acquainted. Bilibin introduced him to the others. The gentlemen assembled at Bilibin's were young, wealthy, gay society men, who here, as in Vienna, formed a special set which Bilibin, their leader, called Les Nôtres, ours. This set, consisting almost exclusively of diplomats, evidently had its own interests, which had nothing to do with war or politics, but related to high society, to certain women, and to the official side of the service. These gentlemen received Prince Andrew as one of themselves, an honor they did not extend to many. From politeness, and to start conversation, they asked him a few questions about the army and the battle, and then the talk went off into merry jests and gossip. "But the best of it was," said one, telling of the misfortune of a fellow diplomat, "that the Chancellor told him flatly that his appointment to London was a promotion, and that he was so to regard it. Can you fancy the figure he cut?" "But the worst of it, gentlemen, I'm giving Kouragin away to you, is that that man suffers, and this Don Juan, wicked fellow, is taking advantage of it." Prince Hippolyte was lolling in a lounge chair with his legs over its arm. He began to laugh. "Tell me about that," he said. "Oh, you Don Juan, you serpent," cried several voices. "You, Bolkonski, don't know," said Bilibin, turning to Prince Andrew, "that all the atrocities of the French army, I nearly said of the Russian army, are nothing compared to what this man has been doing among the women." "La femme est la compagne de l'homme." "Woman is man's companion," announced Prince Hippolyte, and began looking through a lorgnette at his elevated legs. Bilibin and the rest of ours burst out laughing in Hippolyte's face, and Prince Andrew saw that Hippolyte, of whom he had to admit he had almost been jealous on his wife's account, was the butt of this set. "Oh, I must give you a treat," Bilibin whispered to Bolkonski. "Kouragin is exquisite when he discusses politics. You should see his gravity." He sat down beside Hippolyte and, wrinkling his forehead, began talking to him about politics. Prince Andrew and the others gathered round these two. "The Berlin cabinet cannot express a feeling of alliance," began Hippolyte, gazing round with importance at the others, "without expressing, as in its last note, you understand. Besides, unless His Majesty the Emperor derogates from the principle of our alliance..." "Wait, I've not finished," he said to Prince Andrew, seizing him by the arm. "I believe that intervention will be stronger than non-intervention. He paused. "Well, finally, one cannot impute the non-receipt of our dispatch of November 18th. That is how it will end." And he released Bolkonski's arm to indicate that he had now quite finished. "Demosthenes, I know thee by the pebble thou secretest in thy golden mouth," said Bilibin, and the mop of hair on his head moved with satisfaction. Everybody laughed, and Hippolyte louder than anyone. He was evidently distressed and breathed painfully, but could not restrain the wild laughter that convulsed his usually impassive features. "Well now, gentlemen," said Bilibin, "Bolkonski is my guest in this house and in Brünn itself. I want to entertain him as far as I can with all the pleasures of life here. If we were in Vienna, it would be easy, but here in this wretched Moravian hole it is more difficult, and I beg you all to help me. Brünn's attractions must be shown him. You can undertake the theater, I society, and you, Hippolyte, of course, the women. We must let him see Amélie. She's exquisite," said one of ours, kissing his fingertips. "In general, we must turn this bloodthirsty soldier to more humane interests," said Bilibin. "I shall scarcely be able to avail myself of your hospitality, gentlemen. It is already time for me to go, replied Prince Andrew, looking at his watch.
Where to?
To the Emperor.
Oh, oh, oh. Well, au revoir, Bolkonski. Au revoir, Prince.
Come back early to dinner, cried several voices. We'll take you in hand. When speaking to the Emperor, try as far as you can to praise the way that provisions are supplied and the routes indicated, said Bilibin, accompanying him to the hall. I should like to speak well of them, but as far as I know the facts, I can't, replied Bolkonski, smiling.
Well, talk as much as you can, anyway. He has a passion for giving audiences, but he does not like talking himself and can't do it, as you will see.
Chapter 9. Prince Andrew received by the Emperor Francis. Bilibin's story of the Tabor Bridge. At the levee, Prince Andrew stood among the Austrian officers, as he had been told to, and the Emperor Francis merely looked fixedly into his face and just nodded to him with his long head. But after it was over, the adjutant he had seen the previous day ceremoniously informed Bolkonski that the Emperor desired to give him an audience. The Emperor Francis received him standing in the middle of the room. Before the conversation began, Prince Andrew was struck by the fact that the Emperor seemed confused and blushed, as if not knowing what to say. Tell me, when did the battle begin? He asked hurriedly. Prince Andrew replied. Then followed other questions, just as simple. Was Kutuzov well? When had he left Krems? And so on. The Emperor spoke as if his sole aim were to put a given number of questions. The answers to these questions, as was only too evident, did not interest him.
At what o'clock did the battle begin? Asked the Emperor.
I cannot inform your Majesty at what o'clock the battle began at the front, but at Dürrenstein, where I was, our attack began after 5 in the afternoon, replied Bolkonski, growing more animated and expecting that he would have a chance to give a reliable account, which he had already in his mind, of all he knew and had seen. But the Emperor smiled and interrupted him.
How many miles?
From where to where, Your Majesty?
From Dürrenstein to Krems.
3.5 miles, Your Majesty.
The French have abandoned the left bank?
According to the scouts, the last of them crossed on rafts during the night.
Is there sufficient forage in Krems?
Forage has not been supplied to the extent... The Emperor interrupted him.
At what o'clock was General Schmidt killed?
At 7 o'clock, I believe.
At 7 o'clock?
It's very sad, very sad. The Emperor thanked Prince Andrew and bowed. Prince Andrew withdrew and was immediately surrounded by courtiers on all sides. Everywhere he saw friendly looks and heard friendly words. Yesterday's adjutant reproached him for not having stayed at the palace and offered him his own house. The Minister of War came up and congratulated him on the Maria Theresa Order of the Third Grade, which the Emperor was conferring on him. The Empress's Chamberlain invited him to see Her Majesty. The Archduchess also wished to see him. He did not know whom to answer, and for a few seconds collected his thoughts. Then the Russian ambassador took him by the shoulder, led him to the window, and began to talk to him. Contrary to Bilibin's forecast, the news Andrew had brought was joyfully received. A Thanksgiving service was arranged. Kutuzov was awarded the Grand Cross of Maria Theresa, and the whole army received rewards. Bolkonski was invited everywhere, and had to spend the whole morning calling on the principal Austrian dignitaries. Between 4 and 5 in the afternoon, having made all his calls, he was returning to Bilibin's house, thinking out a letter to his father about the battle and his visit to Brünn. At the door, he found a vehicle half full of luggage. Franz, Bilibin's man, was dragging a portmanteau with some difficulty out of the front door. Before returning to Bilibin's, Prince Andrew had gone to a bookshop to provide himself with some books for the campaign, and had spent some time in the shop.
"What is it?" he asked.
"Oh, Your Excellency," said Franz, with difficulty rolling the portmanteau into the vehicle. "We have to move on still farther. The scoundrel is again at our heels."
"Eh? What?" asked Prince Andrew.
Bilibin came out to meet him. His usually calm face showed excitement.
"There now, confess that this is delightful," said he. "This affair of the Tabor Bridge at Vienna. They've crossed without striking a blow."
Prince Andrew could not understand.
"But where do you come from not to know what every coachman in the town knows?"
"I come from the Archduchess. I heard nothing there."
"And you didn't see that everybody is packing up?"
"I did not."
What is it all about? Inquired Prince Andrew impatiently.
What's it all about? Why, the French have crossed the bridge that Auersperg was defending, and the bridge was not blown up, so Murat is now rushing along the road to Brünn and will be here in a day or two.
What, here? But why did they not blow up the bridge if it was mined?
That is what I ask you.
No one, not even Bonaparte, knows why. Bolkonski shrugged his shoulders.
But if the bridge is crossed, it means that the army, too, is lost. It will be cut off, said he.
That's just it, answered Bilibin. Listen. The French entered Vienna, as I told you.
Very well.
Next day, which was yesterday, those gentlemen, Messieurs les Maréchaux, the marshals, Murat, Lannes, and Belliard, mount and ride to the bridge. Observe that all three are Gascons. Gentlemen, says one of them, you know the Tabor Bridge is mined and doubly mined, and that there are menacing fortifications at its head, and an army of 15,000 men has been ordered to blow up the bridge and not let us cross? But it will please our sovereign, the Emperor Napoleon, if we take this bridge, so let us three go and take it.
Yes, let's, say the others.
And off they go and take the bridge, cross it, and now with their whole army are on this side of the Danube, marching on us, you, and your lines of communication.
Stop jesting, said Prince Andrew sadly and seriously.
This news grieved him, and yet he was pleased. As soon as he learned that the Russian army was in such a hopeless situation, it occurred to him that it was he who was destined to lead it out of this position. That here was the Toulon that would lift him from the ranks of obscure officers and offer him the first step to fame. Note, it was at Toulon, when the Republicans besieged it in 1793, that Napoleon first greatly distinguished himself.
Listening to Bilibin, Andrew was already imagining how on reaching the army he would give an opinion at the War Council which would be the only one that could save the army, and how he alone would be entrusted with the executing of the plan.
Stop this jesting, he said.
I'm not jesting, Bilibin went on. Nothing is truer or sadder. These gentlemen ride onto the bridge alone and wave white handkerchiefs. They assure the officer on duty that they, the marshals, are on their way to negotiate with Prince Auersperg. He lets them enter the Tête de Pont, bridgehead. They spin him 1,000 gasconades, saying that the war is over, that the Emperor Francis is arranging a meeting with Bonaparte, that they desire to see Prince Auersperg, and so on. The officer sends for Auersperg. These gentlemen embrace the officers, crack jokes, sit on the cannon, and meanwhile a French battalion gets to the bridge unobserved, flings the bags of incendiary material into the water, and approaches the Tête de Pont. At length appears the Lieutenant General, our dear Prince Auersperg von Mautern himself. Dearest foe, flower of the Austrian army, hero of the Turkish wars, hostilities are ended, we can shake one another's hand. The Emperor Napoleon burns with impatience to make Prince Auersperg's acquaintance. In a word, those gentlemen, Gascons indeed, so bewildered him with fine words, and he so flattered by his rapidly established intimacy with the French marshals, and so dazzled by the sight of Murat's mantle and ostrich plumes, qu'il n'y voit que du feu et oublie celui qu'il devait faire faire sur l'ennemi. That their fire gets into his eyes, and he forgets that he ought to be firing at the enemy. In spite of the animation of his speech, Bilibin did not forget to pause after this mode to give time for its due appreciation. The French battalion rushes to the bridgehead, spikes the guns, and the bridge is taken. But what is best of all, he went on, his excitement subsiding under the delightful interest of his own story, is that the sergeant in charge of the cannon, which was to give the signal to fire the mines and blow up the bridge, this sergeant, seeing that the French troops were running onto the bridge, was about to fire, but Lannes stayed his hand. The sergeant, who was evidently wiser than his general, goes up to Auersperg and says, Prince, you are being deceived. Here are the French. Murat, seeing that all is lost, if the sergeant is allowed to speak, turns to Auersperg with feigned astonishment, he's a true Gascon, and says, I don't recognize the world-famous Austrian discipline if you allow a subordinate to address you like that. It was a stroke of genius. Prince Auersperg feels his dignity at stake, and orders the sergeant to be arrested.
Come, you must own that this affair of the Tabor Bridge is delightful. It is not exactly stupidity, nor rascality. It may be treachery, said Prince Andrew, vividly imagining the gray overcoats, wounds, the smoke of gunpowder, the sounds of firing, and the glory that awaited him. Not that either. That puts the court in too bad a light, replied Bilibin. It's not treachery, nor rascality, nor stupidity. It is just as at Ulm. It is... He seemed to be trying to find the right expression. C'est du mac. Nous sommes maqués. It is a bit of mac. We are macked, he concluded, feeling that he had produced a good epigram, a fresh one that would be repeated. His hitherto puckered brow became smooth as a sign of pleasure, and with a slight smile, he began to examine his nails. Where are you off to? He said suddenly to Prince Andrew, who had risen and was going toward his room. I'm going away.
Where to?
To the army. But you meant to stay another 2 days. But now I'm off at once. And Prince Andrew, after giving directions about his departure, went to his room. Do you know, mon cher, said Bilibin, following him, I've been thinking about you. Why are you going? And in proof of the conclusiveness of his opinion, all the wrinkles vanished from his face. Prince Andrew looked inquiringly at him and gave no reply. Why are you going? I know you think it your duty to gallop back to the army now that it is in danger. I understand that. Mon cher, it is heroism. Not at all, said Prince Andrew. But as you're a philosopher, be a consistent one. Look at the other side of the question, and you will see that your duty, on the contrary, is to take care of yourself. Leave it to those who are no longer fit for anything else. You've not been ordered to return, and have not been dismissed from here. Therefore, you can stay, and go with us wherever our ill luck takes us. They say we're going to Olmütz, and Olmütz is a very decent town. You and I will travel comfortably in my calèche. Do stop joking, Bilibin, cried Bolkonski. I'm speaking sincerely as a friend. Consider, where and why are you going when you might remain here? You are faced by one of two things, and the skin over his left temple puckered. Either you will not reach your regiment before peace is concluded, or you will share defeat and disgrace with Kutuzov's whole army. And Bilibin unwrinkled his temple, feeling that the dilemma was insoluble. I cannot argue about it, replied Prince Andrew coldly. But he thought, I am going to save the army. My dear fellow, you are a hero, said Bilibin. Chapter 10. Prince Andrew returns to Kutuzov. Bagration sent to Holabrin. Napoleon's letter to Murat. That same night, having taken leave of the Minister of War, Bolkonski set off to rejoin the army, not knowing where he would find it and fearing to be captured by the French on the way to Krems. In Brünn, everybody attached to the court was packing up, and the heavy baggage was already being dispatched to Olmütz. Near Hetzelsdorf, Prince Andrew struck the high road along which the Russian army was moving with great haste and in the greatest disorder. The road was so obstructed with carts that it was impossible to get by in a carriage. Prince Andrew took a horse and a Cossack from a Cossack commander, and hungry and weary, making his way past the baggage wagons, rode in search of the commander-in-chief and of his own luggage. Very sinister reports of the position of the army reached him as he went along, and the appearance of the troops in their disorderly flight confirmed these rumors.
Cette armée russe, que l'or de l'Angleterre a transporté des extrémités de l'univers, nous allons lui faire éprouver le même sort, le sort de l'armée d'Ulm.
That Russian army which has been brought from the ends of the earth by English gold, we shall cause to share the same fate, the fate of the army at Ulm. He remembered these words in Bonaparte's address to his army at the beginning of the campaign, and they awoke in him astonishment at the genius of his hero, a feeling of wounded pride and a hope of glory. And should there be nothing left but to die, he thought, well, if need be, I shall do it no worse than others. He looked with disdain at the endless, confused mass of detachments, carts, guns, artillery, and again baggage wagons and vehicles of all kinds overtaking one another
and blocking the muddy road, three and sometimes four abreast. From all sides, behind and before, as far as ear could reach, there were the rattle of wheels, the creaking of carts and gun carriages, the tramp of horses, the crack of whips, shouts, the urging of horses, and the swearing of soldiers, orderlies, and officers. All along the sides of the road, fallen horses were to be seen, some flayed, some not, and broken-down carts, beside which solitary soldiers sat waiting for something, and again soldiers straggling from their companies, crowds of whom set off to the neighboring villages, or returned from them dragging sheep, fowls, hay, and bulging sacks. At each ascent or descent of the road, the crowds were yet denser, and the din of shouting more incessant. Soldiers, floundering knee-deep in mud, pushed the guns and wagons themselves. Whips cracked, hoofs slipped, traces broke, and lungs were strained with shouting. The officers directing the march rode backward and forward between the carts. Their voices were but feebly heard amid the uproar, and one saw by their faces that they despaired of the possibility of checking this disorder. "Here is our dear Orthodox Russian army," thought Bolkonski, recalling Bilibin's words. Wishing to find out where the commander-in-chief was, he rode up to a convoy. Directly opposite to him came a strange one-horse vehicle, evidently rigged up by soldiers out of any available materials, and looking like something between a cart, a cabriolet, and a calèche. A soldier was driving, and a woman enveloped in shawl sat behind the apron under the leather hood of the vehicle. Prince Andrew rode up and was just putting his question to a soldier when his attention was diverted by the desperate shrieks of the woman in the vehicle. An officer in charge of transport was beating the soldier who was driving the woman's vehicle for trying to get ahead of others, and the strokes of his whip fell on the apron of the equipage. The woman screamed piercingly. Seeing Prince Andrew, she leaned out from behind the apron, and, waving her thin arms from under the woolen shawl, cried, "Mr. Aide-de-camp! Mr. Aide-de-camp, for heaven's sake, protect me! What will become of us? I'm the wife of the doctor of the 7th Chasseurs. They won't let us pass. We're left behind and have lost our people."
"I'll flatten you into a pancake," shouted the angry officer to the soldier. "Turn back with your slut.
Mr. Aide-de-camp, help me. What does it all mean?" screamed the doctor's wife.
"Kindly let this cart pass. Don't you see it's a woman?" said Prince Andrew, riding up to the officer. The officer glanced at him, and without replying, turned again to the soldier.
"I'll teach you to push on. Back! Let them pass, I tell you," repeated Prince Andrew, compressing his lips. "And who are you?" cried the officer, turning on him with tipsy rage. "Who are you? Are you in command here, eh? I'm commander here, not you. Go back or I'll flatten you into a pancake," repeated he.
This expression evidently pleased him.
"That was a nice snub for the little aide-de-camp," came a voice from behind.
Prince Andrew saw that the officer was in that state of senseless, tipsy rage when a man does not know what he is saying. He saw that his championship of the doctor's wife and her queer trap might expose him to what he dreaded more than anything in the world, to ridicule. But his instinct urged him on. Before the officer finished his sentence, Prince Andrew, his face distorted with fury, rode up to him and raised his riding whip.
"Kindly let them pass!"
The officer flourished his arm and hastily rode away.
"It's all the fault of these fellows on the staff that there's this disorder," he muttered. "Do as you like."
Prince Andrew, without lifting his eyes, rode hastily away from the doctor's wife, who was calling him her deliverer. And, recalling with a sense of disgust the minutest details of this humiliating scene, he galloped on to the village where he was told that the commander-in-chief was. On reaching the village, he dismounted and went to the nearest house, intending to rest, if but for a moment, eat something, and try to sort out the stinging and tormenting thoughts that confused his mind. "This is a mob of scoundrels and not an army," he was thinking, as he went up to the window of the first house, when a familiar voice called him by name. He turned round. Nesvitsky's handsome face looked out of the little window. Nesvitsky, moving his moist lips as he chewed something and flourishing his arm, called him to enter.
"Bolkonski! Bolkonski, don't you hear, eh? Come quick!" he shouted.
Entering the house, Prince Andrew saw Nyesvitsky and another adjutant having something to eat. They hastily turned round to him, asking if he had any news. On their familiar faces he read agitation and alarm. This was particularly noticeable on Nyesvitsky's usually laughing countenance. "Where's the commander-in-chief?" asked Volkonsky.
"Here, in that house," answered the adjutant.
"Well, is it true that it's peace and capitulation?" asked Nyesvitsky.
"I was going to ask you. I know nothing except that it was all I could do to get here. And we, my dear boy, it's terrible. I was wrong to laugh at Mach. We're getting it still worse," said Nyesvitsky. "But sit down, have something to eat."
"You won't be able to find either your baggage or anything else now, Prince. And God only knows where your man Peter is," said the other adjutant.
"Where are headquarters?"
"We're to spend the night in Tsnaim."
"Well, I've got all I need into packs for 2 horses," said Nyesvitsky. "They've made up splendid packs for me, fit to cross the Bohemian Mountains with. It's a bad lookout, old fellow. But what's the matter with you? You must be ill to shiver like that," he added, noticing that Prince Andrew winced as at an electric shock.
"It's nothing," replied Prince Andrew. He had just remembered his recent encounter with the doctor's wife and the convoy officer.
"What is the commander-in-chief doing here?" he asked.
"I can't make out at all," said Nyesvitsky.
"Well, all I can make out is that everything is abominable, abominable, quite abominable," said Prince Andrew. And he went off to the house where the commander-in-chief was.
Passing by Kutuzov's carriage and the exhausted saddle horses of his suite, with their Cossacks who were talking loudly together, Prince Andrew entered the passage. Kutuzov himself, he was told, was in the house with Prince Bagration and Weyrother. Weyrother was the Austrian general who had succeeded Schmidt. In the passage, little Kozlovsky was squatting on his heels in front of a clerk. The clerk, with cuffs turned up, was hastily writing at a tub turned bottom upwards. Kozlovsky's face looked worn. He, too, had evidently not slept all night. He glanced at Prince Andrew and did not even nod to him.
"Second line, have you written it?" he continued, dictating to the clerk. "The Kiev Grenadiers, Podolian."
"One can't write so fast, Your Honor," said the clerk, glancing angrily and disrespectfully at Kozlovsky. Through the door came the sounds of Kutuzov's voice, excited and dissatisfied, interrupted by another, an unfamiliar voice. From the sound of these voices, the inattentive way Kozlovsky looked at him, the disrespectful manner of the exhausted clerk, the fact that the clerk and Kozlovsky were squatting on the floor by a tub so near to the commander-in-chief, and from the noisy laughter of the Cossacks holding the horses near the window, Prince Andrew felt that something important and disastrous was about to happen. He turned to Kozlovsky with urgent questions.
"Immediately, Prince," said Kozlovsky. "Dispositions for Bagration."
"What about capitulation?"
"Nothing of the sort. Orders are issued for a battle."
Prince Andrew moved toward the door from whence voices were heard. Just as he was going to open it, the sound ceased, the door opened, and Kutuzov, with his eagle nose and puffy face, appeared in the doorway. Prince Andrew stood right in front of Kutuzov, but the expression of the commander-in-chief's one sound eye showed him to be so preoccupied with thoughts and anxieties as to be oblivious of his presence. He looked straight at his adjutant's face without recognizing him.
"Well, have you finished?" said he to Kozlovsky.
"One moment, Your Excellency." Bagration, a gaunt, middle-aged man of medium height with a firm, impassive face of Oriental type, came out after the commander-in-chief.
"I have the honor to present myself," repeated Prince Andrew, rather loudly, handing Kutuzov an envelope.
"Ah, from Vienna? Very good. Later, later." Kutuzov went out into the porch with Bagration.
"Well, goodbye, Prince," said he to Bagration. "My blessing, and may Christ be with you in your great endeavor."
His face suddenly softened, and tears came into his eyes. With his left hand he drew Bagration toward him, and with his right, on which he wore a ring, he made the sign of the cross over him, with a gesture evidently habitual, offering his puffy cheek. But Bagration kissed him on the neck instead.
"Christ be with you," Kutuzov repeated, and went toward his carriage.
"Get in with me," said he to Volkonsky. Your Excellency, I should like to be of use here. Allow me to remain with Prince Bagration's detachment.
Get in, said Kutuzov. And noticing that Bolkonski still delayed, he added, I need good officers myself. Need them myself. They got into the carriage and drove for a few minutes in silence. There is still much, much before us, he said, as if with an old man's penetration he understood all that was passing in Bolkonski's mind. If a tenth part of his detachment returns, I shall thank God, he added, as if speaking to himself. Prince Andrew glanced at Kutuzov's face only a foot distant from him and involuntarily noticed the carefully washed seams of the scar near his temple, where an Ismail bullet had pierced his skull, and the empty eye socket. Yes, he has a right to speak so calmly of those men's death, thought Bolkonski. That is why I beg to be sent to that detachment, he said. Kutuzov did not reply. He seemed to have forgotten what he had been saying and sat plunged in thought. 5 minutes later, gently swaying on the soft springs of the carriage, he turned to Prince Andrew. There was not a trace of agitation on his face. With delicate irony, he questioned Prince Andrew about the details of his interview with the Emperor, about the remarks he had heard at court concerning the Krems affair, and about some ladies they both knew. On November 1st, Kutuzov had received through a spy news that the army he commanded was in an almost hopeless position. The spy reported that the French, after crossing the bridge at Vienna, were advancing an immense force upon Kutuzov's line of communication with the troops that were arriving from Russia. If Kutuzov decided to remain at Krems, Napoleon's army of 150,000 men would cut him off completely and surround his exhausted army of 40,000, and he would find himself in the position of Mack at Ulm. If Kutuzov decided to abandon the road connecting him with the troops arriving from Russia, he would have to march with no road into unknown parts of the Bohemian mountains, defending himself against superior forces of the enemy and abandoning all hope of a junction with Buxhoeveden. If Kutuzov decided to retreat along the road from Krems to Olmütz to unite with the troops arriving from Russia, he risked being forestalled on that road by the French who had crossed the Vienna Bridge, and, encumbered by his baggage and transport, having to accept battle on the march against an enemy three times as strong who would hem him in from two sides. Kutuzov chose this latter course. The French, the spy reported, having crossed the Vienna Bridge, were advancing by forced marches toward Znaim, which lay 66 miles off on the line of Kutuzov's retreat. If he reached Znaim before the French, there would be great hope of saving the army. To let the French forestall him at Znaim meant the exposure of his whole army to a disgrace such as that of Ulm, or to utter destruction. But to forestall the French with his whole army was impossible. The road for the French from Vienna to Znaim was shorter and better than the road for the Russians from Krems to Znaim. The night he received the news, Kutuzov sent Bagration's vanguard 4,000 strong to the right across the hills from the Krems-Znaim to the Vienna-Znaim road. Bagration was to make this march without resting and to halt facing Vienna with Znaim to his rear, and if he succeeded in forestalling the French, he was to delay them as long as possible. Kutuzov himself, with all his transport, took the road to Znaim. Marching 30 miles that stormy night across roadless hills with his hungry, ill-shod soldiers, and losing a third of his men as stragglers by the way, Bagration came out on the Vienna-Znaim road at Hollabrünn, a few hours ahead of the French who were approaching Hollabrünn from Vienna. Kutuzov, with his transport, had still to march for some days before he could reach Znaim. Hence Bagration, with his 4,000 hungry, exhausted men, would have to detain for days the whole enemy army that came upon him at Hollabrünn, which was clearly impossible. But a freak of fate made the impossible possible. The success of the trick that had placed the Vienna Bridge in the hands of the French without a fight led Murat to try to deceive Kutuzov in a similar way. Meeting Bagration's weak detachment on the Znaim road, he supposed it to be Kutuzov's whole army. To be able to crush it absolutely, he awaited the arrival of the rest of the troops who were on their way from Vienna, and with this object offered a 3 days truce on condition that both armies should remain in position without moving. Murat declared that negotiations for peace were already proceeding, and that he therefore offered this truce to avoid unnecessary bloodshed. Count Neustitz, the Austrian general occupying the advanced posts, believed Murat's emissary and retired, leaving Bagration's division exposed. Another emissary rode to the Russian line to announce the peace negotiations and to offer the Russian army the 3 days' truce. Bagration replied that he was not authorized either to accept or refuse a truce, and sent his adjutant to Kutuzov to report the offer he had received. A truce was Kutuzov's sole chance of gaining time, giving Bagration's exhausted troops some rest, and letting the transport and heavy convoys, whose movements were concealed from the French, advance if but one stage nearer Znaim. The offer of a truce gave the only and a quite unexpected chance of saving the army. On receiving the news, he immediately dispatched Adjutant General Wintzingerode, who was in attendance on him, to the enemy camp. Wintzingerode was not merely to agree to the truce, but also to offer terms of capitulation. And meanwhile, Kutuzov sent his adjutants back to hasten to the utmost the movements of the baggage trains of the entire army along the Krems-Znaim road. Bagration's exhausted and hungry detachment, which alone covered this movement of the transport and of the whole army, had to remain stationary in face of an enemy 8 times as strong as itself. Kutuzov's expectations that the proposals of capitulation, which were in no way binding, might give time for part of the transport to pass, and also that Murat's mistake would very soon be discovered, proved correct. As soon as Bonaparte, who was at Schönbrunn,